From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. There's a 9-ton block of sandstone in southern Utah. It contains thousands of bones of baby to adult Utah raptor dinosaurs, at least two iguanodont dinosaurs, and possibly other species. These animals became trapped in a what they believe is a quicksand-like mass while preying on one or more trapped plant-eating dinosaurs. This is a massive project for Utah paleontologists and an exciting discovery for dinosaur lovers. Joining us now is Park City's own paleontologist, Utah State Assistant Paleontologist Don DeBlow. Don, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great to have you on. We're fascinated by this project. Can you describe what this block looks like?
Well, right now it's sitting in the bay over at the Utah Geological Survey's Core Research Center. So we modified a special little garage bay to put it in. And so it's sitting on some massive timbers. We had to drag it off the hill. So right now it looks like a giant field jacket when you see dinosaur bones that are encased in plaster and brought back to the museum to be opened up and prepared. Well, this looks like one of those, but it's a massive one, the size of like a meter thick king size bed. And it's sitting on the big timbers that we had to use to build a frame underneath it so that we could drag it off the hill and keep it in good shape.
And the timing was interesting, moving it from Thanksgiving Point to this new preparation lab at Utah Geological Survey, UGS, because you've been able to, because you have moved it, you are now able to work on it this entire shutdown from the coronavirus. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, John. When we first brought it back, we drug it off the hill in 2015. We first started working on it back in 2005, so there's a very long story in there, which we can go into a little later if you'd like. But yeah, we brought it back up here to Salt Lake City on a big flatbed truck, and it sat for a little while in the parking lot at the UGS. We have a fairly large preparation lab at the Core Research Center, but unfortunately we have a very small door, so we weren't able to put it in there. So luckily, we were searching around to try to find a place that might want to house it for us. So Thanksgiving Point, the Museum of Ancient Life down there, was gracious enough to allow us to put it in there. They did have a big prep lab and a big door. We actually did have to shave the block down a little bit to fit it in their door. But they hosted us for 5 years, which was great. But it is a little ways away from Salt Lake, obviously. Our head preparator, Scott Madsen, would take the front runner down there and do a lot of work. And I'd go down there a couple times a month and work on it. But yeah, they had some other plans for their prep lab. And we also were hoping to maybe get it a little bit closer to home. So yeah, it turned out fortuitous that we moved it right at the end of February last year, just a couple weeks before the COVID shutdown. So that was a lucky break for us. And it's great to have it close by where we can work on it more conveniently.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Park City's own paleontologist, Don DeBlew. Don, I had to say that because I think it's pretty unique and rare. We have a lot of interesting people in this town that do interesting things, but I bet you're the only paleontologist in town. I mean, if you're a realtor in this town, you're one of what, like 1,000 or something, but it's really unusual to have a paleontologist in town. What was the catalyst for you getting into this world?
The world of paleontology or the world of Park City?
Well, it's obvious why you got into the world of Park City, but paleontology.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. As a kid, I was always into science. I figured I wanted to be a scientist, or I liked biology. And, you know, I would tell people I wanted to be an anthropologist or an archaeologist or something like that. Anything with a nice long ology name.
Yeah.
So when I went to I went to college, I started studying biology, and I like the animal side of things. So when I was in college, I took a course in comparative vertebrate anatomy, which was something at the time I didn't even really know what that was, but yeah, it was one of the three choices to take for my major. So I took it, and I had a really amazing professor in that. And that's where we really learn about the vertebrate skeleton. And it's really where you learn about evolution, because you trace the bones from fish, amphibians, reptiles to mammals. And it was really fascinating. And then I took a paleontology course, and I thought that was really great. The fun thing about it is that you can open up a drawer in a museum and there the fossils are. There's lots of scientific endeavors that are really interesting. The results especially are interesting, but the work itself is mixing colorless liquids and things like that, all molecular biology, stuff like that. But what I enjoyed about paleontology was just the hands-on aspect that you can open a drawer and there it is, a fossil of something that lived millions of years ago or even hundreds of millions of years ago.
Right. So that kind of brings me back to, you know, you wanted to talk maybe about the origin of the mega block at the Stikes Quarry. It's named for the young man who discovered it, I think, while he was doing some research project as a graduate student at Arizona State or something. His last name is Sykes. Stikes, sorry. Uh-huh. And that was back in 2005. And so talk about how it is when you're, you know, like, of course, all the reference that we have is like Indiana Jones, right? We picture walking through the Utah desert and just stumbling upon a dinosaur fossil, but it doesn't quite work that way, does it? How was it for this young man, Stikes?
Yeah, so he was doing a master's degree down at Northern Arizona University, and he actually got a hold of Jim Kirkland, my boss, who I think you've had on before. He's mm-hmm. the state paleontologist. He actually did his master's down there in Flagstaff. So Matt was looking for a thesis project, and Jim suggested that he study the poison strip sandstone member of the Cedar Mountain Formation, which is the formation the block comes from and where we do a lot of our dinosaur work. So he was down there studying the rocks, which form the cliff just above the site. And Jim told him, you know, keep your eye out for bone. And it tends to be that geologists don't necessarily find bone very often because they're so focused on the rocks. And it's all about search image. What you're looking for is tends to be what you find. So after he finished, Jim asked him, well, did you find any bone anywhere? He said, no, not really. But on this one hillside, I saw this little piece of white bone sticking out. It almost looked like a human arm bone or something. And Jim thought, wow, a human arm bone, like that means it's probably hollow. You know, maybe there's a theropod dinosaur. So Matt sent some pictures, and Jim and Scott Madsen, who at the time was working up at Dinosaur National Monument as their paleontologist there, Jim and Scott went out armed with these pictures, and it took them about 2 hours of like scouring this hillside to find, you know, matching up the picture, trying to figure out where he could have possibly seen these bones sticking out. And they did find a little bit of white bone sticking out. And that was in 2004. And then in 2005, when we were working out in the region, that's where Jim and I and a few other volunteers and students went up the hill and started digging in at that site.
Well, that's just fascinating. And Utah is one of the richest spots in the world for dinosaur finds. And maybe I've watched too many movies. I know I've watched too many movies. And there are a lot of movies about raiders from another country that scope out some sort of relic, and they go to that country, and under the cover of darkness, they swoop in and they grab the bounty. Does that happen in Utah?
No, not really. We don't have many people coming from other countries. We often go to other countries to dig up fossils.
Not to raid, though.
Some places, you know, as Lynn and John were saying, you picture, you walk up and there's a dinosaur bone laying there for everyone to see. Well, there was a time in Utah where it probably was like that. If you think of the Morrison Formation, where Dinosaur National Monument, some of these great quarries and all these Jurassic dinosaurs that we think of, the big sauropods. If you think about going back maybe a few hundred years ago, like maybe before the settlers got here, and you wandered around the badlands of the Jurassic Morrison Formation, I bet you would find places where there were all these bones just laying around. But over time, a lot of these bones have been scooped up, in some cases by scientists, but There is a fair amount of illegal collecting that happens in Utah. Most of our dinosaur sites are on public land managed by the BLM, or in the case of our Stike site, it's a Sitla parcel, so state trust lands. So vertebrate fossils are protected by law, but that doesn't mean that people don't scoop them up. And back in the good old days of like the 50s and 60s, a lot of those things were taken away and even put in private collections or in rock shops. Going out and searching for dinosaurs, it's very subtle. You just look for little pieces, just like that little tiny piece of bone that was sticking out the hill. It turned out it leads to thousands of bones. And we found probably a dozen sites in Utah that look like nothing on the surface unless you know what you're looking at. But once you dig in a little bit, you realize there's thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of bones in some of these sites if you could see into the hillside.
And Don, I recall the story about Sue, which was a T-Rex, which was probably one of the most intact series of bones and skeleton and everything that we had found at the time for a T-Rex. And there was a big fight over the ownership of Sue. So if this block was found on federal land versus state land, would we have the same amount of control being able to hold on to it by the UGS?
Yeah, well, we all the federal land management agencies, along with like state agencies, it's considered public land. If you found this on your own private land, you actually could keep it and sell the bones, that kind of thing. But here in Utah, there's very little private land in the dinosaur bearing areas of the state. But all of our stuff, in order to get an excavation permit for federal land, BLM, Forest Service, or also for our state lands, you do have to have a certified repository where the bones will go to. So really, when you find it on whether federal or state land here in Utah, it really belongs to the citizens of Utah and the citizens of the United States. So it all has to go to a designated repository where they'll be available for anybody to come and study in perpetuity, hopefully. So.
Wondering about, you know, you talked about the ologies that you were interested in initially. I would imagine, along with paleontology, geology plays a major role. And I'm wondering about this quicksand that the dinosaurs suddenly found themselves in that, you know, ultimately killed them but preserved them in place. We all fear, or I don't know, maybe when I was a kid, I don't know about you, John, but I always feared, my big fear was getting caught in quicksand, as if it was really a thing. Is it a thing? Talk about the quicksand there.
I was hoping to get caught in quicksand.
Yeah, we used to go out into the swamps and try to stick our legs in there and get, I think that's probably a boy thing, Lynn. That was like, we get out in there.
So I'm with sure you, Dan. I'm with you.
If you were with us, I'm sure you would have probably wanted to dive right in. Yeah, the Tarzan movies, yeah, where they'd walk along and sink in there. So it's not super common. You know, usually if you do get in quicksand, you know, you get that suction. You could like stick your arm down there, try to break the suction and get yourself out. And also, if you were stuck, you could lie down, like you wouldn't actually sink into it. You just get stuck in it. And there are modern examples today, sometimes elephants or, you know, camels, animals in places where there is thick mud, they can actually get stuck and they don't really sink in there immediately, but they starve to death and die and their skeletons lay there and they'll eventually get buried in there. So there's really very few examples in the rock record that we know of an actual quicksand model for animals being trapped. But this one, as we dug into the site and realized there were so many bones, that's why that block got so huge, because we could never get around any bones. It kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it was the size of the meter thick king size bed, which was very difficult.
How easy is it? You know, I'm picturing, and I see pictures on your site, taking this huge 9-ton or whatever it was block out. How easy is it to adulterate the site, you know, break bones, kind of ruin what you're trying to preserve as you're extracting it?
Well, that's why it kept getting bigger, because we couldn't take out individual bones like we do at other sites. And then as we were doing it, this gets back a little bit to our quicksand hypothesis. as we were digging it, we realized that most of the bone is in this like green sandstone, but most of the surrounding rock is more of a grayish mudstone. So we realized like this is an odd unit that the bones are in. And then that's when we started thinking about, well, how does sand come up? We realized it could be, in geology, it's called a dewatering feature instead of a quicksand, but a place where water bubbles up to the surface. You'll see modern ones today down near Lake Powell, like on the height delta where water will percolate up. So we think it was something like that. We know there was some lakes nearby and water was probably coming up, bringing the sand up. And animals could, once they get there, they could potentially get trapped. And then of course they would die. And then almost similar to like the La Brea tar pits, like other carnivores would come in to feed on the carcasses there. And they also would get stuck. And then during the time as the water would come up and go down, as the hydraulic head on this changed, it would probably go up and down. And so that's how these animals got kind of disarticulated and mixed around almost in this like layer cake of rock. And then that's when we brought in a sedimentologist. Sedimentology is the study of geology of sediments. He was an expert on that. So then he thought, yeah, this makes sense. And so that's why we wrote that paper and showed that this is one of the few examples of animals that actually getting trapped in a dewatering feature. But we could, I would ask people if they want to learn more, our new Utah Raptor Megablock Fossil Project webpage is up on the Utah Geological Survey website, and that has a nice timeline that we put together of the excavation. So at first it was a matter of just hiking up and down this hill with your tools and doing this slow excavation with dental picks and paintbrushes and a little bit of glue to consolidate the bones. And then eventually it was hauling up water and plaster. So I don't know, I walked up and down that hill probably 200 times. So gets me in good shape for cross-country ski racing, doing all that work. I got, it's like the Norwegian training program, right? Chopping wood, but here it's like digging dinosaurs.
I love that. That's great.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for tuning in. We're speaking with local Park City resident and assistant state paleontologist Don DeBlue. Don, this is very labor-intensive, the work that you're doing on this block. It's going to take you a long time. Are you looking for volunteers to help out? And if so, how would listeners who are interested in helping out on site, how would they get involved?
So we do often have volunteers that come and dig with us in the field. So there's an organization here in Utah called Utah Friends of Paleontology. That's UFOP. It's at utahpaleo.org. So I would recommend that if people are interested, go onto that website and see what volunteer opportunities are having. Actually, tonight we're having our monthly meeting, but we've been doing it virtually, of course. So if you go onto that site, if you're interested in zooming into our annual meeting this this evening at 7, it's actually Alan Titus, who's the paleontologist down at Grand Staircase. And he's going to be speaking about a tyrannosaur site that they don't have down in the Kaparowitz called the Rainbows and Unicorn site. So sometimes we get a little bit goofy out there in the outcrop. So I'm sure it was a great day. It was all rainbows and unicorns. but yeah, so that's an opportunity there. The museum, Natural History Museum of Utah, has volunteer preparators. We've had some, of course, COVID put the kibosh on some of our in-person volunteers. The actual preparation work on the Utah Raptor Megablock is so precise and so difficult that there's really only a handful of people that probably have the skills needed for that. But we do have other things that are a little bit easier to get started with. So yeah, I would recommend that people check out the UFOP site there, Utah Friends of Paleontology. And then the field work is pretty fun. We get people involved in that. But yeah, and then unfortunately, just as we dragged this block down the hill, we lost some of our funding at the UGS. So that's why Scott used to work for us, and he was one of the casualties of the downturn of state funds for our agency right about 2015, 2016. So a lot of the money that we have to help pay for Scott, because he's one of the best micro preparators in the world, has been through fundraising. So one of the reasons we've been putting out some more press releases and keeping the publicity up on this is because we actually had a generous donor who offered us $50,000 if we could match the donations. So we've been looking for that. So on our website, there's links to how you could donate. And we just found out this weekend that somebody, Scott, had set up a GoFundMe site that we've raised over $100,000 on. And somebody just generously gave us $25,000 over the weekend. So
that's great.
The match from our other donor, that's $50,000. So that's, you know, we'd rather be out there digging or in the Raptor Bay with our little air scribes preparing out the bones of this animal instead of being out there fundraising. But sometimes you have to do what you have to do. So.
Don, do Utah raptors or are there any dinosaurs in the dinosaur family that have a central nervous system?
Oh, sure. Yeah, they all have central nervous systems similar to pretty much all vertebrates. Will, you know, from fish to amphibians, reptiles will have central nervous system. And of course, we know now that birds are descendant from a line of dinosaurs. They're not extinct. So we, when we study dinosaurs, we often look to birds for examples of the anatomy. We also look to crocodiles and alligators as they branched off a little bit before the dinosaur bird.
So my question, the reason I asked was, I'm really curious if dinosaurs are sentient beings. In other words, are they able to perceive themselves, feel feelings, feel emotion and pain, that sort of thing?
They would certainly feel pain. Again, I think I would look to birds. I think if you have a pet cockatoo or something, you would probably say that it has emotions and feelings. I mean, probably in a little different way than we do. And whether they perceive themselves, I think it's a little tougher questions. We know that some primates do, and you know, that's a little tougher thing. But no, I assume, you know, now we know that they were very dynamic, very much more bird-like than the lumbering beasts that, you know, we kind of grew up learning about.
Right. Hey, Don, we've just got a couple minutes left, and I wanted, you said the word and you pronounced it. I was wondering how to pronounce it. I think preparator.
Preparator. Yeah, when I type it into a Word document, writing a paper, it has a little red line under it.
Yeah, like that's not a word.
Preparator, like that's not a word. Yeah, so a preparator is someone who prepares dinosaur bones.
Right. So. And how does that differ from a paleontologist?
Most preparators are paleontologists. I guess it depends on, you can be a paleontologist, you might be an academic paleontologist, a college professor who studies the bones in the museum. But it's the more hands-on aspect of it.
Yeah.
So I consider myself a preparator. So part of my job is writing papers and doing research. Part of my job is going to the field and digging up dinosaurs and mammals and fossils. But then when we bring them back to the lab, that's where the work really begins. What you can dig up in an hour or two in the field might take days, weeks, months to prepare in the lab. So it's much more of a hands-on, you're almost more of a craftsman, like a this old bone kind of thing where you're in there. It's very satisfying and fun. And after I've been on the computer for too long, I like to go over to the lab and
get your brush and your pick
and your podcast and my brush and my pick and look under the microscope. Most of the preparation of the mega block is all done under microscope. So it's very exacting and very.
Don, you know, I've always been curious about what we might miss. I know that we take these bones and we think very carefully about how a dinosaur may have lived and if it had feathers or this or that, you know, those sorts of things. And the thing I'm curious about is, you know, for an example, if somebody cut me out of a block of stone 136 million years from now, you know, my clothes would be gone, my flesh would be gone, maybe my bones would be just barely there, my house would be gone, my car would be 136 million years. What sort of stuff do you think we could potentially be missing?
Well, yeah, that is true. If they didn't have bones, we wouldn't have much of anything at all. So. Luckily, bones are made of mineral, and so calcium phosphate, so that lends them to be preserved longer. So, yeah, we do miss a lot, but like I said, we have our bones, and so we can look at modern animals like crocodiles and birds, and by looking at the landmarks on the bones where muscles may have attached, we can learn a lot about how they
put all
together.
That together.
Yeah, occasionally there's some other soft tissues that are preserved. There's some fabulous preservation in places like China, where there's feathers and gut contents and things like that.
Don, I have one last question before we let you go, and it goes back to this quicksand that I'm so fascinated with. So when we're in southern Utah and we see that kind of green limestone, is that an indicator? Has that been at some point a quicksand? We've got 30 seconds.
I know we could go on for a lot longer. Thanks for having me. But yeah, so you just see like a green layer like in the rocks is what you're thinking
yeah,
of?
Yes.
Not necessarily. I mean, some of those are just the minerals. When we have the red oxidation minerals, iron, you see the red colors. Sometimes if it was more of a reducing environment, like a wetter environment where there was less oxidation and iron precipitation, then you have those green colors. So it's not necessarily quicksand. And like I said, it's fairly rare. I mean, there could be river, swamp, land deposits, that kind of thing. So there's all kinds of possibilities.
Don DeBlue, he's Park City resident and assistant state paleontologist. Don, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio, and continued success in learning about this block and all of the other projects you have going on.
Oh, thank you so much. I enjoyed it, and I was wondering when you guys were going to have me on.
we've been waiting. So if someone wants to go and donate, because we just finished a pledge drive last week, so we know all about fundraising here at KPCW. Do you just go to the geology.utah.gov, and you find the button to donate?
Yeah, and then also if you go on GoFundMe, there's the GoFundMe, the Utah Raptor Project. So,
all right.
And that's good for just small little donations. But if you want to give us a big one, then you can talk to us and we'll work with you on that one.
Okay, JW will give you a call. Thanks, Don. Great to have you. Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.